Chapter 8 Continued. By the time Halloween arrived, Harry was regretting his rash promise to go to the Death Day party. The rest of the school were happily anticipating their Halloween feast. The great hall had been decorated with the usual live bats. Hagrid's vast pumpkins had been carved into lanterns large enough for three men to sit in, and there were rumours that Dumbledore had booked a troop of dancing skeletons for the entertainment. "A promise is a promise," Hermione reminded Harry bossily. "You said you'd go to the Death Day party." So, at 7 o'clock, Harry, Ron and Hermione walked straight past the doorway to the packed great hall, which was glittering invitingly with gold plates and candles, and directed their steps instead towards the dungeons. The passageway leading to Nearly Headless Nick's party had been lined with candles too, though the effect was far from cheerful. These were long, thin, jet-black tapers, all burning bright blue, casting a dim, ghostly light even over their own living faces. The temperature dropped with every step they took. As Harry shivered and drew his robes tightly around him, he heard what sounded like a thousand fingernails scraping an enormous blackboard. "Is that supposed to be music?" Ron whispered. They turned a corner and saw Nearly Headless Nick standing at a doorway hung with black velvet drapes. "My dear friends," he said mournfully, "welcome, welcome, so pleased you could come." He swept off his plumed hat and bowed them inside. It was an incredible sight. The dungeon was full of hundreds of pearly white, translucent people, mostly drifting around a crowded dance floor, waltzing to the dreadful, quavering sound of 30 musical saws, played by an orchestra on a black-draped platform. A chandelier overhead blazed midnight blue with a thousand more black candles. Their breath rose in a mist before them. It was like stepping into a freezer. "Shall we have a look around?" Harry suggested, wanting to warm up his feet. "Careful not to walk through anyone," said Ron nervously, and they set off around the edge of the dance floor. They passed a group of gloomy nuns, a ragged man wearing chains, and the fat friar, a cheerful Hufflepuff ghost, who was talking to a knight with an arrow sticking out of his forehead. Harry wasn't surprised to see that the bloody Baron, a gaunt, staring Slytherin ghost covered in silver bloodstains, was being given a wide berth by the other ghosts. "Oh, no!" said Hermione, stopping abruptly. "Turn back! Turn back! I don't want to talk to Moaning Myrtle!" "Who?" said Harry, as they backtracked quickly. "She haunts the girls' toilet on the first floor," said Hermione. "She haunts a toilet?" "Yes, it's been out of order all year because she keeps having tantrums and flooding the place. I never went in there anyway if I could avoid it. It's awful trying to go to the loo with her wailing at you." "Look, food," said Ron. On the other side of the dungeon was a long table, also covered in black velvet. They approached it eagerly, but next moment had stopped in their tracks, horrified. The smell was quite disgusting. Large, rotten fish were laid on handsome silver platters. Cakes, burned charcoal black, were heaped on salvers. There was a great maggoty haggis, a slab of cheese covered in furry green mould, and, in pride of place, an enormous grey cake in the shape of a tombstone with tar-like icing forming the words, "Sir Nicholas de Mimsey Porpington died 31st October, 1492. Harry watched, amazed, as a portly ghost approached the table, crouched low, and walked through it, his mouth held wide so that it passed through one of the stinking salmon. "Can you taste it if you walk through it?" Harry asked him. "Almost," said the ghost sadly, and he drifted away. "I expect they've let it rot to give it a stronger flavour," said Hermione knowledgeably, pinching her nose and leaning closer to look at the putrid haggis. "Can we move? I feel sick," said Ron. They had barely turned around, however, when a little man swooped suddenly from under the table and came to a halt in mid-air before them. "Hello, Peeves," said Harry cautiously. Unlike the ghosts around them, Peeves the Poltergeist was the very reverse of pale and transparent. He was wearing a bright orange party hat, a revolving bow tie, and a broad grin on his wide, wicked face.
"Nibbles?" he said sweetly, offering them a bowl of peanuts covered in fungus.
"No thanks," said Hermione.
"Heard you talking about poor Myrtle," said Peeves, his eyes dancing. "Rude you was about poor Myrtle."
He took a deep breath and bellowed, "Oi! Myrtle!"
"Oh, no, Peeves, don't tell her what I said. She'll be really upset," Hermione whispered frantically. "I didn't mean it. I don't mind. Hello, Myrtle."
The squat ghost of a girl had glided over. She had the glummest face Harry had ever seen, half hidden behind lank hair and thick, pearly spectacles.
"What?"
she said sulkily.
"How are you, Myrtle?"
said Hermione in a falsely bright voice.
"It's nice to see you out of the toilet."
Myrtle sniffed.
"Miss Granger was just talking about you," said Peeves slyly in Myrtle's ear. "Just saying how nice you look tonight,"
said Hermione, glaring at Peeves. Myrtle eyed Hermione suspiciously.
"You're making fun of me,"
she said, silver tears welling rapidly in her small, see-through eyes.
"No, honestly, didn't I just say how nice Myrtle's looking?"
said Hermione, nudging Harry and Ron painfully in the ribs.
"Oh, yeah, she did." "Don't lie to me,"
Myrtle gasped, tears now flooding down her face, while Peeves chuckled happily over her shoulder.
"Do you think I don't know what people call me behind my back? Fat Myrtle! Ugly Myrtle! Miserable, moaning, moping Myrtle!" "You've missed out Spotty," Peeves hissed in her ear.
Moaning Myrtle burst into anguished sobs and fled from the dungeon. Peeves shot after her, pelting her with mouldy peanuts, yelling, "Spotty! Spotty!"
"Oh, dear,"
said Hermione sadly. Nearly headless Nick now drifted towards them through the crowd.
"Enjoying yourselves?"
"Oh, yes," they lied.
"Not a bad turnout," said Nearly Headless Nick proudly. "The Wailing Widow came all the way up from Kent. It's nearly time for my speech. I'd better go and warn the orchestra."
The orchestra, however, stopped playing at that very moment. They, and everyone else in the dungeon, fell silent, looking around in excitement, as a hunting horn sounded.
"Oh, here we go," said Nearly Headless Nick bitterly.
Through the dungeon wall burst a dozen ghost horses, each ridden by a headless horseman. The assembly clapped wildly. Harry started to clap too, but stopped quickly at the sight of Nick's face. The horses galloped into the middle of the dance floor and halted, rearing and plunging. A large ghost at the front, whose bearded head was under his arm, blowing the horn, leapt down, lifted his head high in the air so he could see over the crowd, everyone laughed, and strode over to Nearly Headless Nick, squashing his head back onto his neck.
"Nick!" he roared. "How are you? Head still hanging in there?"
He gave a hearty guffaw and clapped Nearly Headless Nick on the shoulder.
"Welcome, Patrick," said Nick stiffly.
"Livons!"
said Sir Patrick, spotting Harry, Ron and Hermione, and giving a huge fake jump of astonishment so that his head fell off again. The crowd howled with laughter.
"Very amusing," said Nearly Headless Nick darkly.
"Don't mind Nick," shouted Sir Patrick's head from the floor. "Still upset we won't let him join the hunt, but I mean to say, look at the fella!"
"I think," said Harry hurriedly, at a meaningful look from Nick, "Nick's very frightening and,
"Ha!" yelled Sir Patrick's head. "Betty asked you to say that."
"If I could have everyone's attention, it's time for my speech,"
said Nearly Headless Nick loudly, striding towards the podium and climbing into an icy blue spotlight.
"My late lamented lords, ladies and gentlemen, it is my great sorrow—"
But nobody heard much more. Sir Patrick and the rest of the headless hunt had just started a game of head hockey, and the crowd were turning to watch. Nearly Headless Nick tried vainly to recapture his audience, but gave up as Sir Patrick's head went sailing past him to loud cheers. Harry was very cold by now, not to mention hungry.
"I can't stand much more of this," Ron muttered, his teeth chattering, as the orchestra ground back into action and the ghosts swept back onto the dance floor.
"Let's go," Harry agreed. They backed towards the door, nodding and beaming at anyone who looked at them, and a minute later were hurrying back up the passageway full of black candles.
"Pudding might not be finished yet," said Ron hopefully, leading the way towards the steps to the entrance hall.
And then Harry heard it. Rip, tear, kill. It was the same voice, the same cold, murderous voice he had heard in Lockhart's office. He stumbled to a halt, clutching at the stone wall, listening with all his might, looking around, squinting up and down the dimly lit passageway.
"Harry, what are you—"
"It's that voice again. Shut up a minute."
"So hungry for so long."
"Listen," said Harry urgently, and Ron and Hermione froze, watching him.
"Kill, time to kill."
The voice was growing fainter. Harry was sure it was moving away, moving upwards. A mixture of fear and excitement gripped him as he stared at the dark ceiling. How could it be moving upwards? Was it a phantom to whom stone ceilings didn't matter?
"This way!" he shouted, and he began to run up the stairs into the entrance hall.
It was no good hoping to hear anything here. The babble of talk from the Halloween feast was echoing out of the great hall. Harry sprinted up the marble staircase to the first floor, Ron and Hermione clattering behind him.
"Harry, what are we—"
"Shh!" Harry strained his ears. Distantly, from the floor above and growing fainter still, he heard the voice,
"I smell blood. I smell blood."
His stomach lurched.
"It's going to kill someone," he shouted, and ignoring Ron and Hermione's bewildered faces, he ran up the next flight of steps three at a time, trying to listen over his own pounding footsteps.
Harry hurtled around the whole of the second floor, Ron and Hermione panting behind him, not stopping until they turned a corner into the last deserted passage.
"Harry, what was all that about?" said Ron, wiping sweat off his face. "I couldn't hear anything!"
But Hermione gave a sudden gasp, pointing down the corridor.
"Look!"
Something was shining on the wall ahead. They approached slowly, squinting through the darkness. Foot-high words had been daubed on the wall between two windows, shimmering in the light cast by the flaming torches. "The Chamber of Secrets has been opened. Enemies of the air, beware."
"What's that thing hanging underneath?" said Ron, a slight quiver in his voice.
As they edged nearer, Harry almost slipped over. There was a large puddle of water on the floor. Ron and Hermione grabbed him, and they inched towards the message, eyes fixed on a dark shadow beneath it. All three of them realized what it was at once, and leapt backwards with a splash. Mrs. Norris, the caretaker's cat, was hanging by her tail from the torch bracket. She was stiff as a board, her eyes wide and staring. For a few seconds, they didn't move. Then Ron said, "Let's get out of here."
"Shouldn't we try and help?"
Harry began awkwardly. "Trust me," said Ron, "we don't want to be found here." But it was too late. A rumble, as though of distant thunder, told them that the feast had just ended. From either end of the corridor where they stood came the sound of hundreds of feet climbing the stairs and the loud, happy talk of well-fed people. Next moment, students were crashing into the passage from both ends. The chatter, the bustle, the noise died suddenly as the people in front spotted the hanging cat. Harry, Ron, and Hermione stood alone in the middle of the corridor as silence fell among the mass of students pressing forward to see the grisly sight. Then someone shouted through the quiet, "Enemies of the air, beware. You'll be next. Mudbloods." It was Draco Malfoy. He had pushed to the front of the crowd, his cold eyes alive, his usually bloodless face flushed as he grinned at the sight of the hanging, immobile cat. Chapter 9. The Writing on the Wall.
"What's going on here? What's going on?"
Attracted, no doubt, by Malfoy's shout, Argus Filch came shouldering his way through the crowd. Then he saw Mrs. Norris and fell back, clutching his face in horror.
"My cat! My cat! What's happened to Mrs. Norris?"
he shrieked, and his popping eyes fell on Harry.
"You!" he screeched. "You! You've murdered my cat! You've killed her! I'll kill you! I'll—"
Argus! Dumbledore had arrived on the scene, followed by a number of other teachers. In seconds he had swept past Harry, Ron, and Hermione and detached Mrs. Norris from the torch bracket. "Come with me, Argus," he said to Filch. "You too, Mr. Potter, Mr. Weasley, Miss Granger." Lockhart stepped forward eagerly. "My office is nearest, Headmaster, just upstairs. Please feel free." "Thank you, Gilderoy," said Dumbledore. The silent crowd parted to let them pass. Lockhart, looking excited and important, hurried after Dumbledore. So did Professors McGonagall and Snape. As they entered Lockhart's darkened office, there was a flurry of movement across the walls. Harry saw several of the Lockharts in the pictures dodging out of sight, their hair in rollers. The real Lockhart lit the candles on his desk and stood back. Dumbledore lay Mrs. Norris on the polished surface and began to examine her. Harry, Ron, and Hermione exchanged tense looks and sank into chairs outside the pool of candlelight, watching. The tip of Dumbledore's long, crooked nose was barely an inch from Mrs. Norris's fur. He was looking at her closely through his half-moon spectacles, his long fingers gently prodding and poking. Professor McGonagall was bent almost as close, her eyes narrowed. Snape loomed behind them, half in shadow, wearing a most peculiar expression. It was as though he was trying hard not to smile. And Lockhart was hovering around all of them, making suggestions.
"Oh, it was definitely a curse that killed her. Probably the transmogrification torture. I've seen it used many times. So unlucky I wasn't there. I know the very counter-curse that would have saved her."
Lockhart's comments were punctuated by Filch's dry, racking sobs. He was slumped in a chair by the desk, unable to look at Mrs. Norris, his face in his hands. Much as he detested Filch, Harry couldn't help feeling a bit sorry for him, though not nearly as sorry as he felt for himself. If Dumbledore believed Filch, he would be expelled for sure. Dumbledore was now muttering strange words under his breath and tapping Mrs. Norris with his wand, but nothing happened. She continued to look as though she had been recently stuffed.
"I remember something very similar happening in Ouagadougou," said Lockhart. "A series of attacks. The full story's in my autobiography. I was able to provide the townsfolk with various amulets, which cleared the matter up at once."
The photographs of Lockhart on the walls were all nodding in agreement as he talked. One of them had forgotten to remove his hairnet. At last Dumbledore straightened up. "She's not dead, Argus," he said softly. Lockhart stopped abruptly in the middle of counting the number of murders he had prevented.
"Not dead?" choked Filch, looking through his fingers at Mrs. Norris. "But why is she all stiff and frozen?"
"She has been petrified," said Dumbledore.
"Ah, I thought so," said Lockhart. "But how, I cannot say."
"Ask him!" shrieked Filch, turning his blotched and tear-stained face to Harry.
"No second year could have done this," said Dumbledore firmly. "It would take dark magic of the most advanced—"
"He did it! He did it!" Filch spat, his pouchy face purpling. "You saw what he wrote on the wall. He found in my office. He knows I'm a—"
Filch's face worked horribly.
"He knows I'm a squib," he finished. "I never touched Mrs. Norris," Harry said loudly.
uncomfortably aware of everyone looking at him, including all the Lockharts on the walls. "And I don't even know what a squib is."
"Rubbish!" snarled Filch. "He saw my quickspell letter!"
"If I might speak, Headmaster," said Snape from the shadows, and Harry's sense of foreboding increased. He was sure nothing Snape had to say was going to do him any good.
"Potter and his friends may simply have been in the wrong place at the wrong time," he said, a slight sneer curling his mouth as though he doubted it. "But we do have a set of suspicious circumstances here. Why were they in the upstairs corridor at all? Why weren't they at the Halloween feast?"
Harry, Ron, and Hermione all launched into an explanation about the Death Day party.
"There were hundreds of ghosts. They'll tell you we were there."
"But why not join the feast afterwards?" said Snape, his black eyes glittering in the candlelight. "Why go up to that corridor?"
Ron and Hermione looked at Harry.
Because,
Harry said, his heart thumping very fast.
Something told him it would sound very far-fetched if he told them he had been led there by a bodiless voice no one but he could hear.
"Because we were tired and wanted to go to bed," he said.
"Without any supper?" said Snape, a triumphant smile flickering across his gaunt face. "I didn't think ghosts provided food fit for living people at their parties."
"We weren't hungry," said Ron loudly, as his stomach gave a huge rumble.
Snape's nasty smile widened.
"I suggest, Headmaster, that Potter is not being entirely truthful," he said. "It might be a good idea if he were deprived of certain privileges until he is ready to tell us the whole story. I personally feel he should be taken off the Gryffindor Quidditch team until he is ready to be honest."
"Really, Severus," said Professor McGonagall sharply, "I see no reason to stop the boy playing Quidditch. This cat wasn't hit over the head with a broomstick. There is no evidence at all that Potter has done anything wrong."
Dumbledore was giving Harry a searching look. His twinkling light blue gaze made Harry feel as though he was being X-rayed.
"Innocent until proven guilty, Severus," he said firmly.
Snape looked furious. So did Filch.
"My cat has been petrified," he shrieked, his eyes popping. "I want to see some punishment."
"We will be able to cure her, Argus," said Dumbledore patiently. "Madam Sprout recently managed to procure some mandrakes. As soon as they have reached their full size, I will have a potion made which will revive Mrs. Norris."
"I'll make it," Lockhart butted in. "I must have done it 100 times. I could whip up a mandrake restorative draught in my sleep."
"Excuse me," said Snape icily, "but I believe I am the potions master at this school."
There was a very awkward pause.
"You may go," Dumbledore said to Harry, Ron, and Hermione.
They went, as quickly as they could, without actually running. When they were a floor up from Lockhart's office, they turned into an empty classroom and closed the door quietly behind them. Harry squinted at his friends' darkened faces.
"Do you think I should have told them about that voice I heard?"
"No," said Ron, without hesitation. "Hearing voices no one else can hear isn't a good sign, even in the wizarding world."
Something in Ron's voice made Harry ask, "You do believe me, don't you?"
"Course I do," said Ron quickly. "But you must admit it's weird."
"I know it's weird," said Harry. "The whole thing's weird. What was that writing on the wall about? The chamber has been opened. What's that supposed to mean?"
"You know, it rings a sort of bell," said Ron slowly. "I think someone told me a story about a secret chamber at Hogwarts once. It might have been Bill."
"And what on earth's a squib?" said Harry.
To his surprise, Ron stifled a snigger.
"Well, it's not funny, really, but as it's Filch," he said. "A squib is someone who was born into a wizarding family but hasn't got any magic powers. Kind of the opposite of muggle-born wizards. But squibs are quite unusual. If Filch is trying to learn magic from a quickspell course, I reckon he must be a squib. It would explain a lot, like why he hates students so much."
Ron gave a satisfied smile. "He's bitter." A clock chimed somewhere.
"Midnight," said Harry. "We'd better get to bed before Snape comes along and tries to frame us for something else." for a few days, the school could talk of little but the attack on Mrs. Norris. Filch kept it fresh in everyone's minds by pacing the spot where she had been attacked, as though he thought the attacker might come back. Harry had seen him scrubbing the message on the wall with Mrs. Scour's all-purpose magical mess remover, but to no effect. The words still gleamed as brightly as ever on the stone. When Filch wasn't guarding the scene of the crime, he was skulking red-eyed through the corridors, lunging out at unsuspecting students and trying to put them in detention for things like breathing loudly and looking happy. Ginny Weasley seemed very disturbed by Mrs. Norris's fate. According to Ron, she was a great cat lover. "But you hadn't really got to know Mrs. Norris," Ron told her bracingly. "Honestly, we're much better off without her." Ginny's lip trembled. "Stuff like this doesn't often happen at Hogwarts," Ron assured her. "They'll catch the nutter who did it and have him out of here in no time. I just hope he's got time to petrify Filch before he's expelled." "I'm only joking," Ron added hastily, as Ginny blanched. The attack had also had an effect on Hermione. It was quite usual for Hermione to spend a lot of time reading, but she was now doing almost nothing else. Nor could Harry and Ron get much response from her when they asked her what she was up to, and not until the following Wednesday did they find out. Harry had been held back in potions, where Snape had made him stay behind to scrape tube worms off the desks. After a hurried lunch, he went upstairs to meet Ron in the library and saw Justin Finch Fletchley, the Hufflepuff boy from Herbology, coming towards him. Harry had just opened his mouth to say hello when Justin caught sight of him, turned abruptly, and sped off in the opposite direction. Harry found Ron at the back of the library, measuring his History of Magic homework. Professor Binns had asked for a 3-foot-long composition on the Medieval Assembly of European Wizards. "I don't believe it. I'm still 8 inches short," said Ron furiously, letting go of his parchment, which sprang back into a roll. "And Hermione's done 4 feet 7 inches, and her writing's tiny." "Where is she?" asked Harry, grabbing the tape measure and unrolling his own homework. "Somewhere over there," said Ron, pointing along the shelves. "Looking for another book. I think she's trying to read the whole library before Christmas." Harry told Ron about Justin Finch Fletchley running away from him. "Don't know why you care. I thought he was a bit of an idiot," said Ron, scribbling away, making his writing as large as possible. "All that rubbish about Lockhart being so great." Hermione emerged from between the bookshelves. She looked irritable and at last seemed ready to talk to them. "All the copies of Hogwarts, A History, have been taken out," she said, sitting down next to Harry and Ron, "and there's a 2-week waiting list. I wish I hadn't left my copy at home, but I couldn't fit it in my trunk with all the Lockhart books." "Why do you want it?" said Harry. "The same reason everyone else wants it," said Hermione, "to read up on the legend of the Chamber of Secrets." "What's that?" said Harry quickly. "That's just it. I can't remember," said Hermione, biting her lip. "And I can't find the story anywhere else." "Hermione, let me read your composition," said Ron desperately, checking his watch. "No, I won't," said Hermione, suddenly severe. "You've had 10 days to finish it." "I only need another 2 inches. Go on." The bell rang. Ron and Hermione led the way to History of Magic, bickering. History of Magic was the dullest subject on their timetable. Professor Binns, who taught it, was their only ghost teacher, and the most exciting thing that ever happened in his classes was his entering the room through the blackboard. Ancient and shrivelled, many people said he hadn't noticed he was dead. He had simply got up to teach one day and left his body behind him in an armchair in front of the staff room fire. His routine had not varied in the slightest since. Today was as boring as ever. Professor Binns opened his notes and began to read in a flat drone like an old vacuum cleaner until nearly everyone in the class was in a deep stupor, occasionally coming round long enough to copy down a name or date, then falling asleep again. He had been speaking for 30 minutes when something happened that had never happened before. Hermione put up her hand. Professor Binns, glancing up in the middle of a deadly dull lecture on the International Warlock Convention of 1289, looked amazed. "Miss
Granger, Professor, I was wondering if you could tell us anything about the Chamber of Secrets, said Hermione in a clear voice. Dean Thomas, who had been sitting with his mouth hanging open, gazing out of the window, jerked out of his trance. Lavender Brown's head came up off her arms, and Neville's elbow slipped off his desk. Professor Binns blinked.
"My subject is History of Magic," he said in his dry, wheezy voice. "I deal with facts, Miss Granger, not myths and legends."
He cleared his throat with a small noise like chalk snapping and continued.
"In September of that year, a subcommittee of Sardinian sorcerers—"
He stuttered to a halt. Hermione's hand was waving in the air again.
"Miss Grant?"
"Please, sir, don't legends always have a basis in fact?" Professor Binns was looking at her in such amazement, Harry was sure no student had ever interrupted him before, alive or dead.
"Well," said Professor Binns slowly, "yes, one could argue that, I suppose."
He peered at Hermione as though he had never seen a student properly before.
"However, the legend of which you speak is such a very sensational, even ludicrous tale."
But the whole class was now hanging on Professor Binns' every word. He looked dimly at them all, every face turned to his. Harry could tell he was completely thrown by such an unusual show of interest.
"Oh, very well," he said slowly. "Let me see. The Chamber of Secrets. You all know, of course, that Hogwarts was founded over 1,000 years ago, the precise date is uncertain, by the 4 greatest witches and wizards of the age. The 4 schoolhouses are named after them: Godric Gryffindor, Helga Hufflepuff, Rowena Ravenclaw, and Salazar Slytherin. They built this castle together, far from prying muggle eyes, for it was an age when magic was feared by common people, and witches and wizards suffered much persecution."
He paused, gazed blearily around the room, and continued.
"For a few years, the founders worked in harmony together, seeking out youngsters who showed signs of magic and bringing them to the castle to be educated. But then disagreements sprang up between them. A rift began to grow between Slytherin and the others. Slytherin wished to be more selective about the students admitted to Hogwarts. He believed that magical learning should be kept within all magic families. He disliked taking students of muggle parentage, believing them to be untrustworthy. After a while, there was a serious argument on the subject between Slytherin and Gryffindor, and Slytherin left the school."
Professor Binns paused again, pursing his lips, looking like a wrinkled old tortoise.
"Reliable historical sources tell us this much," he said. "But these honest facts have been obscured by the fanciful legend of the Chamber of Secrets. The story goes that Slytherin had built a hidden chamber in the castle, of which the other founders knew nothing. Slytherin, according to the legend, sealed the Chamber of Secrets so that none would be able to open it until his own true heir arrived at the school. The heir alone would be able to unseal the Chamber of Secrets, unleash the horror within, and use it to purge the school of all who were unworthy to study magic."
There was silence as he finished telling the story. But it wasn't the usual sleepy silence that filled Professor Binns' classes. There was unease in the air as everyone continued to watch him, hoping for more. Professor Binns looked faintly annoyed.
"The whole thing is arrant nonsense, of course," he said. "Naturally, the school has been searched for evidence of such a chamber many times by the most learned witches and wizards. It does not exist. A tale told to frighten the gullible."
Hermione's hand was back in the air.
"Sir, what exactly do you mean by the horror within the chamber?"
"That is believed to be some sort of monster, which the heir of Slytherin alone can control," said Professor Binns in his dry, reedy voice.
The class exchanged nervous looks.
"'I tell you the thing does not exist,' said Professor Binns, shuffling his notes. "'There is no chamber and no monster.'
"'But, sir,' said Seamus Finnegan, "'if the chamber can only be opened by Slytherin's true heir, "'no one else would be able to find it, would they?'
"'Nonsense, O'Flaherty,' said Professor Binns in an aggravated tone. "'If a long succession of Hogwarts headmasters and headmistresses haven't found the thing—'
"'But, Professor,' piped up Parvati Patil, "'you'd probably have to use dark magic to open it.'
"'Just because a wizard doesn't use dark magic doesn't mean he can't, Miss Pennyfeather,' snapped Professor Binns. "'I repeat, if the likes of Dumbledore—'
"'But maybe you've got to be related to Slytherin, so Dumbledore couldn't,'
began Dean Thomas, but Professor Binns had had enough.
"'That will do,' he said sharply. "'It is a myth.' It does not exist. There is not a shred of evidence that Slytherin ever built so much as a secret broom cupboard. I regret telling you such a foolish story. We will return, if you please, to history, to solid, believable, verifiable fact.
And within 5 minutes, the class had sunk back into its usual torpor. "'I always knew Salazar Slytherin was a twisted old loony,' Ron told Harry and Hermione, as they fought their way through the teeming corridors at the end of the lesson to drop off their bags before dinner. "'But I never knew he started all this pure-blood stuff. "'I wouldn't be in his house if you paid me. "'Honestly, if the Sorting Hat had tried to put me in Slytherin, I'd have got the train straight back home.' "'Hermione nodded fervently, but Harry didn't say anything.' His stomach had just dropped unpleasantly. Harry had never told Ron and Hermione that the Sorting Hat had seriously considered putting him in Slytherin. He could remember, as though it was yesterday, the small voice that had spoken in his ear when he'd placed the hat on his head a year before. "'You could be great, you know. It's all here in your head. And Slytherin would help you on the way to greatness, no doubt about that.' But Harry, who had already heard of Slytherin House's reputation for turning out dark wizards, had thought desperately, "'Not Slytherin!' And the hat had said, "'Oh, well, if you're sure, better be Gryffindor.' As they were shunted along in the throng, Colin Creevy went past.
"'Hiya, Harry!'
"'Hello, Colin,' said Harry automatically.
"'Harry, Harry, a boy in my class has been saying you're—'
But Colin was so small he couldn't fight against the tide of people bearing him towards the great hall. They heard him squeak,
"'See you, Harry!'
and he was gone.
"'What's a boy in his class saying about you?'
Hermione wondered. "'That I'm Slytherin's heir, I expect,' said Harry, his stomach dropping another inch or so as he suddenly remembered the way Justin Finch-Fletchley had run away from him at lunchtime. "'People here'll believe anything,' said Ron in disgust. The crowd thinned, and they were able to climb the next staircase without difficulty. "'Do you really think there's a Chamber of Secrets?' Ron asked Hermione.
"'I don't know,' she said, frowning. "'Dumbledore couldn't cure Mrs. Norris, and that makes me think that whatever attacked her might not be, well, human.'
As she spoke, they turned a corner and found themselves at the end of the very corridor where the attack had happened. They stopped and looked. The scene was just as it had been that night, except that there was no stiff cat hanging from the torch bracket, and an empty chair stood against the wall, bearing the message, "'The chamber has been opened.' "'That's where Filch has been keeping guard,' Ron muttered. They looked at each other. The corridor was deserted. "'Can't hurt to have a poke around,' said Harry, dropping his bag and getting to his hands and knees so that he could crawl along, searching for clues.
"'Scorch marks,' he said. "'Here, and here.' "'Come and look at this,' said Hermione. "'This is funny.'
Harry got up and crossed to the window next to the message on the wall. Hermione was pointing at the topmost pane, where around 20 spiders were scuttling, apparently fighting to get through a small crack in the glass. A long, silvery thread was dangling like a rope, as though they had all climbed it in their hurry to get outside.
"'Have you ever seen spiders act like that?' said Hermione, wonderingly.
"'No.' said Harry. "'Have you, Ron?'
"'Ron?'
He looked over his shoulder. Ron was standing well back and seemed to be fighting the impulse to run.
"What's up?" said Harry.
"I don't like spiders," said Ron tensely.
"I never knew that," said Hermione, looking at Ron in surprise. "You've used spiders in potions loads of times."
"I don't mind them dead," said Ron, who was carefully looking anywhere but at the window. "I just don't like the way they move."
Hermione giggled.
"It's not funny," said Ron fiercely. "If you must know, when I was three, Fred turned my teddy bear into a dirty great spider because I broke his toy broomstick. You wouldn't like them either if you'd been holding your bear and suddenly it had too many legs and..."
He broke off, shuddering. Hermione was obviously still trying not to laugh. Feeling they had better get off the subject, Harry said, "Remember all that water on the floor? Where did that come from? Someone's mopped it up."
"It was about here," said Ron,
recovering himself to walk a few paces past Filch's chair and pointing. "Level with this door." He reached for the brass doorknob, but suddenly withdrew his hand as though he'd been burned. "What's the matter?" said Harry.
"Can't go in there," said Ron gruffly. "That's a girl's toilet."
"Oh, Ron, there won't be anyone in there," said Hermione, standing up and coming over. "That's Moaning Myrtle's place. Come on, let's have a look."
And ignoring the large out-of-order sign, she opened the door. It was the gloomiest, most depressing bathroom Harry had ever set foot in. Under a large, cracked and spotted mirror were a row of chipped stone sinks. The floor was damp and reflected the dull light given off by the stubs of a few candles burning low in their holders. The wooden doors to the cubicles were flaking and scratched, and one of them was dangling off its hinges. Hermione put her fingers to her lips and set off towards the end cubicle. When she reached it, she said,
"Hello, Myrtle. How are you?"
Harry and Ron went to look. Moaning Myrtle was floating on the cistern of the toilet, picking a spot on her chin.
"This is a girl's bathroom," she said,
eyeing Ron and Harry suspiciously.
"They're not girls."
"No," Hermione agreed. "I just wanted to show them how nice it is in here."
She waved vaguely at the dirty old mirror and the damp floor.
"Ask her if she saw anything," Harry mouthed at Hermione.
"What are you whispering?" said Myrtle, staring at him.
"Nothing," said Harry quickly. "We wanted to ask..."
"I wish people would stop talking behind my back," said Myrtle, in a voice choked with tears. "I do have feelings, you know, even if I am dead."
"Myrtle, no one wants to upset you," said Hermione. "Harry only..."
"No one wants to upset me. That's a good one,"
howled Myrtle.
"My life was nothing but misery at this place, and now people come along ruining my death."
"We wanted to ask you if you'd seen anything funny lately," said Hermione quickly, "because a cat was attacked right outside your front door on Halloween." "Did you see anyone near here that night?" said Harry.
"I wasn't paying attention," said Myrtle dramatically. "Peeves upset me so much I came in here and tried to kill myself. Then, of course, I remembered that I'm...
"Already dead?" said Ron helpfully.
Myrtle gave a tragic sob, rose up in the air, turned over, and dived head first into the toilet, splashing water all over them and vanishing from sight. From the direction of her muffled sobs, she had come to rest somewhere in the U-bend. Harry and Ron stood with their mouths open, but Hermione shrugged wearily and said,
"Honestly, that was almost cheerful for Myrtle. Come on, let's go."
Harry had barely closed the door on Myrtle's gurgling sobs when a loud voice made all three of them jump.
"Ron!"
Percy Weasley had stopped dead at the head of the stairs, prefect badge agleam, an expression of complete shock on his face.
"That's a girl's bathroom," he gasped. "What were you?"
"Just having a look around," Ron shrugged. "Clues, you know."
Percy swelled in a manner that reminded Harry forcefully of Mrs. Weasley.
"Get away from there," he said,
striding towards them and starting to chivvy them along, flapping his arms.
"Don't you care what this looks like? Coming back here while everyone's at dinner?"
"Why shouldn't we be here?"
said Ron hotly, stopping short and glaring at Percy.
"Listen, we never laid a finger on that cat."
"That's what I told Ginny," said Percy fiercely.
"But she still seems to think you're going to be expelled. I've never seen her so upset. Crying her eyes out.
You might think of her. All the first years are thoroughly overexcited by this business. You don't care about Ginny, said Ron, whose ears were reddening now. You're just worried I'm going to mess up your chances of being head boy. 5 points from Gryffindor, Percy said tersely, fingering his prefect badge. And I hope it teaches you a lesson. No more detective work, or I'll write to Mum. And he strode off, the back of his neck as red as Ron's ears. Harry, Ron and Hermione chose seats as far as possible from Percy in the common room that night. Ron was still in a very bad temper and kept blotting his charms homework. When he reached absently for his wand to remove the smudges, it ignited the parchment. Fuming almost as much as his homework, Ron slammed the Standard Book of Spells Grade 2 shut. To Harry's surprise, Hermione followed suit. "Who can it be, though?" she said in a quiet voice, as though continuing a conversation they had just been having. "Who'd want all the squibs and muggleborns out of Hogwarts?" "Let's think," said Ron in mock puzzlement. "Who do we know who thinks muggleborns are scum?" He looked at Hermione. Hermione looked back, unconvinced. "If you're talking about Malfoy..." "Of course I am," said Ron. "You heard him. You'll be next, mudbloods. Come on, you've only got to look at his foul rat face to know it's him." "Malfoy, the heir of Slytherin?" said Hermione, sceptically. "Look at his family," said Harry, closing his books too. "The whole lot of them have been in Slytherin. He's always boasting about it. They could easily be Slytherin's descendants. His father's definitely evil enough." "They could have had the key to the Chamber of Secrets for centuries," said Ron, "handing it down, father to son." "Well," said Hermione cautiously, "I suppose it's possible." "But how do we prove it?" said Harry darkly. "There might be a way," said Hermione slowly, dropping her voice still further with a quick glance across the room at Percy. "Of course, it would be difficult and dangerous, very dangerous. We'd be breaking about 50 school rules, I expect." "If in a month or so you feel like explaining, you will let us know, won't you?" said Ron irritably. "All right," said Hermione coldly. "What we'd need to do is to get inside the Slytherin common room and ask Malfoy a few questions without him realizing it's us." "But that's impossible," Harry said, as Ron laughed. "No, it's not," said Hermione. "All we'd need would be some polyjuice potion." "What's that?" said Ron and Harry together. "Snape mentioned it in class a few weeks ago." "Do you think we've got nothing better to do in potions than listen to Snape?" muttered Ron. "It transforms you into somebody else. Think about it. We could change into three of the Slytherins. No one would know it was us. Malfoy would probably tell us anything." "He's probably boasting about it in the Slytherin common room right now, if only we could hear him." "This polyjuice stuff sounds a bit dodgy to me," said Ron, frowning. "What if we were stuck looking like three of the Slytherins forever?" "It wears off after a while," said Hermione, waving her hand impatiently. "But getting hold of the recipe will be very difficult. Snape said it was in a book called Mosty Potenty Potions, and it's bound to be in the restricted section of the library." There was only one way to get out a book from the restricted section. You needed a signed note of permission from a teacher. "Hard to see why we'd want the book, really," said Ron, "if we weren't going to try and make one of the potions." "I think," said Hermione, "that if we made it sound as though we were just interested in the theory, we might stand a chance." "Oh, come on, no teacher's going to fall for that," said Ron. "They'd have to be really thick." Chapter 10 The Rogue Bludger. Since the disastrous episode of the Pixies, Professor Lockhart had not brought live creatures to class. Instead, he read passages from his books to them, and sometimes reenacted some of the more dramatic bits. He usually picked Harry to help him with these reconstructions. So far, Harry had been forced to play a simple Transylvanian villager, whom Lockhart had cured of a babbling curse, a yeti with a head cold, and a vampire who had been unable to eat anything except lettuce since Lockhart had dealt with him.
Harry was hauled to the front of the class during their very next Defence Against the Dark Arts lesson, this time acting a werewolf. If he hadn't had a very good reason for keeping Lockhart in a good mood, he would have refused to do it.
"Nice loud howl, Harry." "Exactly. And then, if you'll believe it, I pounced like this, slammed him to the floor, thus, with one hand, I managed to hold him down, with my other, I put my wand to his throat, I then screwed up my remaining strength, and performed the immensely complex Homorphous Charm. He let out a piteous moan. Go on, Harry. Higher than that, good. The fur vanished, the fangs shrank, and he turned back into a man. Simple, yet effective. And another village will remember me forever as the hero who delivered them from the monthly terror of werewolf attacks."
The bell rang, and Lockhart got to his feet.
"Homework? Compose a poem about my defeat of the Wagga Wagga werewolf. Signed copies of Magical Me to the author of the best one."
The class began to leave. Harry returned to the back of the room where Ron and Hermione were waiting.
"Ready," Harry muttered.
"Wait till everyone's gone," said Hermione nervously.
"All right."
She approached Lockhart's desk, a piece of paper clutched tightly in her hand, Harry and Ron right behind her.
Professor Lockhart," Hermione stammered, "I wanted to get this book out of the library, just for background reading."
She held out the piece of paper, her hand shaking slightly.
But the thing is, it's in the restricted section of the library, so I need a teacher to sign for it. I'm sure it would help me understand what you say in Gadding with Ghouls about slow-acting venoms."
"Aha, Gadding with Ghouls," said Lockhart, taking the note from Hermione and smiling widely at her. "Possibly my very favourite book. You enjoyed it?"
"Oh, yes," said Hermione eagerly. "So clever, the way you trapped that last one with the tea strainer."
"Well, I'm sure no one will mind me giving the best student in the year a little extra help," said Lockhart warmly, and he pulled out an enormous peacock quill. "Yes, nice, isn't it?" he said, misreading the revolted look on Ron's face. "I usually save it for book signings." He scrawled an enormous loopy signature on the note and handed it back to Hermione.
"So, Harry," said Lockhart, while Hermione folded the note with fumbling fingers and slipped it into her bag. "Tomorrow's the first Quidditch match of the season, I believe. Gryffindor against Slytherin, is it not? I hear you're a useful player."
"I was a seeker, too. I was asked to try for the national squad, but preferred to dedicate my life to the eradication of the dark forces. Still, if ever you feel the need for a little private training, don't hesitate to ask. Always happy to pass on my expertise to less able players."
Harry made an indistinct noise in his throat and then hurried off after Ron and Hermione.
"I don't believe it," he said, as the three of them examined the signature on the note. "He didn't even look at the book we wanted."
"That's because he's a brainless git," said Ron. "But who cares? We've got what we needed."
"He's not a brainless git," said Hermione shrilly, as they half ran towards the library.
"Just because he said you were the best student in the year." They dropped their voices as they entered the muffled stillness of the library. Madame Pince, the librarian, was a thin, irritable woman who looked like an underfed vulture.
"Mosty potenty potions?" she repeated suspiciously, trying to take the note from Hermione, but Hermione wouldn't let go. "I was wondering if I could keep it," she said breathlessly.
"Oh, come on," said Ron, wrenching it from her grasp and thrusting it at Madame Pince. "We'll get you another autograph. Lockhart'll sign anything if it stands still long enough."
Madame Pince held the note up to the light as though determined to detect a forgery, but it passed the test. She stalked away between the lofty shelves and returned several minutes later, carrying a large and mouldy-looking book. Hermione put it carefully into her bag and they left, trying not to walk too quickly or look too guilty. 5 minutes later, they were barricaded in Moaning Myrtle's out-of-order bathroom once again. Hermione had overridden Ron's objections by pointing out that it was the last place anyone in their right minds would go, so they were guaranteed some privacy. Moaning Myrtle was crying noisily in her cubicle, but they were ignoring her, and she them. Hermione opened Mosty Potenty Potions carefully, and the three of them bent over the damp-spotted pages. it was clear from a glance why it belonged in the restricted section. Some of the potions had effects almost too gruesome to think about, and there were some very unpleasant illustrations, which included a man who seemed to have been turned inside out, and a witch sprouting several extra pairs of arms out of her head.
"Here it is," said Hermione excitedly, as she found the page headed The Polyjuice Potion.
It was decorated with drawings of people halfway through transforming into other people. Harry sincerely hoped the artist had imagined the looks of intense pain on their faces.
"This is the most complicated potion I've ever seen," said Hermione as they scanned the recipe. "Lacewing flies, leeches, fluxweed, knotgrass," she murmured, running her finger down the list of ingredients.
"Well, they're easy enough. They're in the student store cupboard. We can help ourselves. Ooh, look, powdered horn of a bicorn. Don't know where we're going to get that. Shredded skin of a boomslang. That'll be tricky too. And, of course, a bit of whoever we want to change into."
"Excuse me," said Ron sharply. "What do you mean, a bit of whoever we're changing into? I'm drinking nothing with crab's toenails in it."
Hermione continued as though she hadn't heard him. "We don't have to worry about that yet, though, because we add those bits last." Ron turned speechless to Harry, who had another worry.
"Do you realise how much we're going to have to steal, Hermione? Shredded skin of boomslang, that's definitely not in the students' cupboard. What are we going to do, break into Snape's private stores? I don't know if this is a good idea."
Hermione shut the book with a snap.
"Well, if you two are going to chicken out, fine," she said.
There were bright pink patches on her cheeks, and her eyes were brighter than usual.
"I don't want to break rules, you know. I think threatening Muggleborns is far worse than brewing up a difficult potion. But if you don't want to find out if it's Malfoy, I'll go straight to Madame Pince now and hand the book back in."
"I never thought I'd see the day when you'd be persuading us to break rules," said Ron.
"All right, we'll do it. But not toenails, okay?"
"How long will it take to make, anyway?" said Harry, as Hermione, looking happier, opened the book again.
"Well, as the fluxweed has got to be picked at the full moon, and the lacewings have got to be stewed for 21 days, I'd say it'll be ready in about a month, if we can get all the ingredients."
"A month?" said Ron. "Malfoy could have attacked half the Muggleborns in the school by then." But Hermione's eyes narrowed dangerously again, and he added swiftly,
"But it's the best plan we've got, so full steam ahead, I say."
However, while Hermione was checking the coast was clear for them to leave the bathroom, Ron muttered to Harry, "It'll be a lot less hassle if you can just knock Malfoy off his broom tomorrow." Harry woke early on Saturday morning and lay for a while thinking about the coming Quidditch match. He was nervous, mainly at the thought of what Wood would say if Gryffindor lost, but also at the idea of facing a team mounted on the fastest racing brooms gold could buy. He had never wanted to beat Slytherin so badly. After half an hour of lying there with his insides churning, he got up, dressed, and went down to breakfast early, where he found the rest of the Gryffindor team huddled at the long, empty table, all looking uptight and not speaking much. As 11 o'clock approached, the whole school started to make its way down to the Quidditch Stadium. It was a muggy sort of day with a hint of thunder in the air. Ron and Hermione came hurrying over to wish Harry good luck as he entered the changing rooms. The team pulled on their scarlet Gryffindor robes, then sat down to listen to Wood's usual pre-match pep talk.
"Slytherin have better brooms than us," he began. "No point denying it. But we've got better people on our brooms. We've trained harder than they have. We've been flying in all weathers."
"Too true," muttered George Weasley. "I haven't been properly dry since August."
"And we're going to make them rue the day they let that little bit of slime Malfoy buy his way onto their team."
Chest heaving with emotion, Wood turned to Harry.
"It'll be down to you, Harry, to show them that a seeker has to have something more than a rich father. Get to that snitch before Malfoy or die trying, Harry, because we've got to win today. We've got to."
"So, no pressure, Harry," said Fred, winking at him. As they walked out onto the pitch, a roar of noise greeted them, mainly cheers, because Ravenclaw and Hufflepuff were anxious to see Slytherin beaten. But the Slytherins in the crowd made their boos and hisses heard too.
Madame Hooch, the Quidditch teacher, asked Flint and Wood to shake hands, which they did, giving each other threatening stares and gripping rather harder than was necessary.
"On my whistle," said Madame Hooch. "Three, two, one!"
With a roar from the crowd to speed them upwards, the 14 players rose towards the leaden sky. Harry flew higher than any of them, squinting around for the snitch.
"All right there, Scarhead!" yelled Malfoy, shooting underneath him as though to show off the speed of his broom.
Harry had no time to reply. At that very moment a heavy black bludger came pelting towards him. He avoided it so narrowly that he felt it ruffle his hair as it passed.
"Close one, Harry,"
said George, streaking past him with his club in his hand, ready to knock the bludger back towards a Slytherin. Harry saw George give the bludger a powerful whack in the direction of Adrian Pusey, but the bludger changed direction in mid-air and shot straight for Harry again. Harry dropped quickly to avoid it, and George managed to hit it hard towards Malfoy. Once again, the bludger swerved like a boomerang and shot at Harry's head. Harry put on a burst of speed and zoomed towards the other end of the pitch. He could hear the bludger whistling along behind him. What was going on? Bludgers never concentrated on one player like this. It was their job to try and unseat as many people as possible. Fred Weasley was waiting for the bludger at the other end. Harry ducked as Fred swung at the bludger with all his might. The bludger was knocked off course.
"That's done it!"
Fred yelled happily. But he was wrong. As though it was magnetically attracted towards Harry, the bludger pelted after him once more, and Harry was forced to fly off at full speed. It had started to rain. Harry felt heavy drops fall onto his face, splattering onto his glasses. He didn't have a clue what was going on in the rest of the game until he heard Lee Jordan, who was commentating, say,
"Slytherin lead, 60-0.
The Slytherin superior brooms were clearly doing their jobs, and meanwhile the mad bludger was doing all it could to knock Harry out of the air. Fred and George were now flying so close to him on either side that Harry could see nothing at all except their flailing arms, and had no chance to look for the snitch, let alone catch it.
"Someone's tampered with this bludger!"
Fred grunted, swinging his bat with all his might at it, as it launched a new attack on Harry.
"We need time out!" said George, trying to signal to Wood and stop the bludger breaking Harry's nose at the same time.
Wood had obviously got the message. Madame Hooch's whistle rang out, and Harry, Fred and George dived for the ground, still trying to avoid the mad bludger.
"What's going on?"
said Wood, as the Gryffindor team huddled together, while Slytherins in the crowd jeered.
"We're being flattened! Fred, George, where were you when that bludger stopped Angelina scoring?"
"We were 20 feet above her, stopping the other bludger murdering Harry, Oliver," said George angrily.
"Someone's fixed it. It won't leave Harry alone. It hasn't gone for anyone else all game. The Slytherins must have done something to it."
"But the bludgers have been locked in Madame Hooch's office since our last practice, and there was nothing wrong with them then,"
said Wood anxiously. Madame Hooch was walking towards them. Over her shoulder, Harry could see the Slytherin team jeering and pointing in his direction.
"Listen," said Harry, as she came nearer and nearer. "With you two flying round me all the time, the only way I'm going to catch the snitch is if it flies up my sleeve,"
said Harry. "Go back to the rest of the team and let me deal with the rogue one."
"Don't be thick," said Fred. "It'll take your head off."
Wood was looking from Harry to the Weasleys.
"Oliver, this is mad," said Alicia Spinett angrily. "You can't let Harry deal with that thing on his own. Let's ask for an inquiry."
"If we stop now, we'll have to forfeit the match," said Harry. "And we're not losing to Slytherin just because of a mad bludger. Come on, Oliver. Tell them to leave me alone."
"This is all your fault," George said angrily to Wood. "Get the snitch or die trying. What a stupid thing to tell him."
Madame Hooch had joined them.
"Ready to resume play?"
she asked Wood. Wood looked at the determined look on Harry's face.
"All right," he said. "Fred, George, you heard Harry. Leave him alone and let him deal with the bludger on his own."
The rain was falling more heavily now. On Madame Hooch's whistle, Harry kicked hard into the air and heard the telltale whoosh of the bludger behind him. Higher and higher Harry climbed. He looped and swooped, spiralled, zigzagged and rolled. Slightly dizzy, he nevertheless kept his eyes wide open.
Rain was speckling his glasses and ran up his nostrils as he hung upside down, avoiding another fierce dive from the bludger. He could hear laughter from the crowd. He knew he must look very stupid, but the rogue bludger was heavy and couldn't change direction as quickly as he could. He began a kind of roller coaster ride around the edges of the stadium, squinting through the silver sheets of rain to the Gryffindor goalposts where Adrian Pusey was trying to get past Wood. A whistling in Harry's ear told him the bludger had just missed him again. He turned right over and sped in the opposite direction.
"Training for the ballet, Potter?" yelled Malfoy, as Harry was forced to do a stupid kind of twirl in mid-air to dodge the bludger.
Off Harry fled, the bludger trailing a few feet behind him, and then, glaring back at Malfoy in hatred, he saw it. The golden snitch. It was hovering inches above Malfoy's left ear, and Malfoy, busy laughing at Harry, hadn't seen it. For an agonizing moment, Harry hung in mid-air, not daring to speed towards Malfoy in case he looked up and saw the snitch. Wham! He had stayed still a second too long. The bludger had hit him at last, smashed into his elbow, and Harry felt his arm break. Dimly, dazed by the searing pain in his arm, he slid sideways on his rain-drenched broom, one knee still crooked over it, his right arm dangling useless at his side. The bludger came pelting back for a second attack, this time aiming at his face. Harry swerved out of the way, one idea firmly lodged in his numb brain. Get to Malfoy. Through a haze of rain and pain, he dived for the shimmering, sneering face below him and saw its eyes widen with fear. Malfoy thought Harry was attacking him. "What the?" he gasped, careering out of Harry's way. Harry took his remaining hand off his broom and made a wild snatch. He felt his fingers close on the cold snitch, but was now only gripping the broom with his legs, and there was a yell from the crowd below as he headed straight for the ground, trying hard not to pass out. With a splattering thud, he hit the mud and rolled off his broom. His arm was hanging at a very strange angle. Riddled with pain, he heard, as though from a distance, a good deal of whistling and shouting. He focused on the snitch, clutched in his good hand. "Aha," he said vaguely. "We've won." And he fainted. He came round, rain falling on his face, still lying on the pitch, with someone leaning over him. He saw a glitter of teeth.
"Oh, no, not you," he moaned.
"Doesn't know what he's saying," said Lockhart loudly to the anxious crowd of Gryffindors pressing around them.
"Not to worry, Harry. I'm about to fix your arm."
"No," said Harry. "I'll keep it like this, thanks." He tried to sit up, but the pain was terrible. He heard a familiar clicking noise nearby.
"I don't want a photo of this, Colin," he said loudly.
"Lie back, Harry," said Lockhart soothingly. "It's a simple charm I've used countless times."
"Why can't I just go to the hospital wing?" said Harry through clenched teeth.
"He should really, Professor," said a muddy Wood, who couldn't help grinning even though his seeker was injured.
"Great capture, Harry. Really spectacular. Your best yet, I'd say."
Through the thicket of legs around him, Harry spotted Fred and George Weasley wrestling the rogue bludger into a box. It was still putting up a terrific fight.
"Stand back," said Lockhart, who was rolling up his jade-green sleeves.
"No, don't," said Harry weakly. But Lockhart was twirling his wand, and a second later had directed it straight at Harry's arm.
A strange and unpleasant sensation started at Harry's shoulder and spread all the way down to his fingertips. It felt as though his arm was being deflated. He didn't dare look at what was happening. He had shut his eyes, his face turned away from his arm, but his worst fears were realized as the people above him gasped, and Colin Creevy began clicking away madly. His arm didn't hurt any more, but nor did it feel remotely like an arm.
"Ah," said Lockhart. "Yes. Well, that can sometimes happen. But the point is, the bones are no longer broken. That's the thing to bear in mind. So, Harry, just toddle up to the hospital wing. Mr. Weasley, Miss Granger, would you escort him? And Madame Pomfrey will be able to tidy you up a bit."
As Harry got to his feet, he felt strangely lopsided. Taking a deep breath,
he looked down at his right side. What he saw nearly made him pass out again. Poking out of the end of his robes was what looked like a thick, flesh-coloured rubber glove. He tried to move his fingers. Nothing happened. Lockhart hadn't mended Harry's bones. He had removed them. Madame Pumphrey wasn't at all pleased.
"You should have come straight to me!" she raged, holding up the sad, limp remainder of what, half an hour before, had been a working arm. "I can mend bones in a second, but growing them back—"
"You will be able to, won't you?" said Harry, desperately.
"I'll be able to, certainly, but it will be painful," said Madame Pumphrey grimly, throwing Harry a pair of pyjamas. "You'll have to stay the night."
Hermione waited outside the curtain drawn around Harry's bed, while Ron helped him into his pyjamas. It took a while to stuff the rubbery, boneless arm into a sleeve.
"How can you stick up for Lockhart now, Hermione, eh?"
Ron called through the curtain as he pulled Harry's limp fingers through the cuff. If Harry had wanted deboning, he would have asked.
"Anyone can make a mistake," said Hermione, "and it doesn't hurt any more, does it, Harry?"
"No," said Harry. "But it doesn't do anything else, either." As he swung himself onto the bed, his arm flapped pointlessly. Hermione and Madame Pumphrey came around the curtain. Madame Pumphrey was holding a large bottle of something labelled Skelligrow.
"You're in for a rough night," she said,
pouring out a steaming beakerful and handing it to him.
"Regrowing bones is a nasty business."
So was taking the Skelligrow. It burned Harry's mouth and throat as it went down, making him cough and splatter. Still tut-tutting about dangerous sports and inept teachers, Madame Pumphrey retreated, leaving Ron and Hermione to help Harry gulp down some water.
"We won, though," said Ron, a grin breaking across his face. "That was some catch you made. Malfoy's face! He looked ready to kill!"
"I want to know how he fixed that bludger," said Hermione darkly. "We can add that to the list of questions we'll ask him when we've taken the polyjuice potion," said Harry, sinking back onto his pillows. "I hope it tastes better than this stuff."
"If it's got bits of Slytherins in it, you've got to be joking," said Ron.
The door of the hospital wing burst open at that moment. Filthy and soaking wet, the rest of the Gryffindor team had arrived to see Harry.
"Unbelievable flying, Harry," said George. "I've just seen Marcus Flint yelling at Malfoy, something about having the snitch on top of his head and not noticing. Malfoy didn't seem too happy."
They had brought cakes, sweets, and bottles of pumpkin juice. They gathered around Harry's bed and were just getting started on what promised to be a good party when Madame Pumphrey came storming over, shouting,
"This boy needs rest. He's got 33 bones to regrow. Out! Out!"
And Harry was left alone, with nothing to distract him from the stabbing pains in his limp arm.